From the studios of KUSP FM in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Marilyn K. Roach is my guest. She's an authority on the Salem witch trials and has written a number of books on the subject. Her latest is Six Women of Salem, the untold story of the accused and their accusers in the Salem witch trials. Marilyn Roach, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for inviting me.
Judging from your book, it's a wonder that anyone survived colonial New England at all, witch or not. Life was pretty hard then.
Yes, it was. There was a war going on with Canada. There's smallpox now and then. Actually, the lifespan was pretty good compared to parts of Europe, but there was still infant mortality and illnesses that they couldn't deal with. It wasn't an easy time.
And they were, it seems, anxious to execute people for one thing or another.
Well, it got out of hand in 1692, certainly.
Not just for being accused of witchcraft, but for all number of infractions you could be executed.
Oh, yes, though actually there were fewer crimes with death penalties than there were in England, fortunately. But murder, that never helped. Adultery was on the books, but I don't think they ever executed anyone for that more than once or twice.
So when we talk about witches, you know, we think of... We either think of witches with a black hat riding a broomstick, or we think of Samantha Stevens twitching her nose.
Oh, yeah. There's a statue of her in Salem.
Really? Of Samantha Stevens?
Yeah, some TV company. It's quite popular with the tourists.
But now, when they were accusing people of witchcraft, were they... Was this a person who would be possessed by the devil, or in cahoots with the devil, or what was a witch exactly?
Oh, well... They assumed it was someone who was in cahoots with the devil, presumably voluntarily, that had allied themselves with the forces of evil instead of with God and the forces of good, but proving it was something else. Usually the suspects were, someone they'd quarreled with a lot, and maybe didn't have too many speaking up for them, although in 1692, Rebecca Nurse had a lot of people speaking up on her behalf, and it didn't do her any good in the end.
And was there ever a case in which a witch considered themselves a witch?
There was something called white witchcraft, or at least it was called that in England. They didn't really call it that here, I think, which was folk magic, but they didn't really consider themselves in league with the devil or anything like that. Some of the accused in 1692... got so confused and rattled by the accusations and the questioning and people being so certain that they were guilty that they confessed to it. And then wondered later why they had done that. Some seemed to have confessed sort of to postpone actually being tried and probably found guilty, that it might save them, which it did because it postponed the trials until things calmed down. In the normal course of things, it would not have helped. But they either were doing it to try and save themselves, or they were just so confused they didn't know what they said, as some of them explained afterwards, and they were appalled that they'd accused themselves.
Well, a person could just be accused, mm-hmm. and if they were accused by the right person, then people would just assume their guilt?
If they had a reputation for being unpleasant, perhaps. Earlier in the century, a great many of the accusations, maybe a third of them, resulted in slander suits from the accused. As Mary English, one of the six women in the title, her mother had been accused by a neighbor who really lost her temper in public one day. And there was a countersuit about that, and mother won because it was a dangerous thing to be called a witch. So you weren't necessarily automatically found guilty or anything like that. But in 92, everything got out of hand.
You know, of course, we sort of think, you know, gee, how primitive and how crazy that they would believe in witchcraft. But, of course, so many other aspects of religious life are still held by a large number of the population, so I guess it's not quite so crazy.
Well, in other parts of the world, I know, there are still not laws against witchcraft, but vigilante actions against people on those grounds, that people have been killed by their neighbors in parts of Africa and Asia and Eastern Europe even. It's not a pleasant thing to think about. But in 92, if the people had thought about it more calmly, of course they thought they were under siege at one point, even by their own lights and their own culture, they would have stopped to think that because the devil is a liar, according to tradition, you can't trust these pronouncements from people who say that that they're being attacked by the devil's minions. It could be, as they pointed, as some of the accused pointed out in the very beginning, if you think you're seeing invisible specters of witches after you, how do you know it's real? How do you know it's not the devil's delusions? Eventually that prevailed, but not at the beginning and not in time for the 19 who were hanged.
We're talking with Marilyn K. Roach, and she is an expert on the Salem witch trials, and her new book is called Six Women of Salem, The Untold Story of the Accused and Their Accusers in the Salem Witch Trials. You've written quite a few books on this subject. How did you get interested in this? Is it your own witchcraft that got you interested?
No. It was a subject that I always found interesting. Some of it's kind of like a train wreck. You can't look away from it.
Yeah.
But there was a library book on it that I took out every so often when I was in high school or something, like around then. I found out later it wasn't all that accurate, but it got me interested. And back during the bicentennial of the Revolution, 75, 76, all kinds of local history was popular then because of celebrations. And Salem published a guidebook to its various attractions and history, which I bought a copy of and went up to Salem on the train, and it's a beautiful place. I mean, there's all sorts of history up there, but I was just so taken with it that I kept looking into it more and more. And excuse me, there were fewer touristy attractions then than there has been since. But I saw a couple of them, and I wasn't too sure about what I'd been told in the course of the presentations. So I thought I should look into that. Maybe there's a book in it, I thought. And 27 years later, the book came out. it took so long that Massachusetts cleared the names of five more of the people who had been found guilty.
The current, you're saying currently, the current government of the state?
2001 they did, yes.
And why did they feel the need to do that?
Oh, well, there was a move by some people who wanted to, you know, just get it straight that these people were not what they were accused of being. And just to clear the names, because there had been, in 1711... the government that was then contemporary with the disaster had cleared the names of the people who petitioned, or their survivors had petitioned, so that they would not be considered criminals. And if they were still alive, that the law wouldn't gear up again against them. And anyway, reputation of something of that magnitude to them, they wanted it clear that that's not what they had done. But some of the names were left out, and five of them got cleared retroactively. However, unfortunately, the acting governor at the time did it on Halloween, so I don't know how seriously they were taking it.
that is unfortunate.
Yeah.
I think popular fiction has it that they were the witches were burned, but that wasn't the true method.
No, on the continent of Europe and in Scotland, where the laws were different. But in England and the English colonies, it was hanging for felons, and it was hanging in Salem.
Now, you talked about 1692, the people believing they were under siege.
Well,
How did that happen? What did that mean exactly?
Oh, well, there were a lot of things going wrong at once that seemed to have triggered lack of calm contemplation about what was going on, because there was war with Canada. France and England had been at odds for a long time. King Louis would have liked the English colonies, so there were raiding parties sent across the borders into the frontier areas, which would be New Hampshire at that point, as far south as that, and even into Massachusetts, not into Salem itself, but pretty darn close to it, a couple of towns away. And their native allies, who had other reasons to resent the settlers, would be part of these raiding parties, and people would be killed, towns burned, and people would be kidnapped if they survived and marched back to Canada and held hostage. So there's that hanging over their heads. There's, because of the war situation, there's privateers off the coast preying on the local fishing and coastal vessels. There's smallpox cropping up now and then. There is the problem with England in that the Massachusetts Charter, which made the government legal, had been suspended some decades before, back when, during the return of the king after the Commonwealth period. All of the charters were negated until the various parties that held them, like universities, colonies, banks, and so on, until they proved their loyalty to the crown, and Massachusetts was a bit more rebellious than most, so they didn't get that reinstated until 1692, actually. They got it in June. So they had to rewrite the laws so they would not conflict with British law. And actually, British law was a little more harsh with the death penalties at that time, but both countries had laws against witchcraft. So they were trying to settle that at the same time. And then there were all sorts of local frictions. The problem had started in Salem Village, which was the rural part of Salem, which was bigger then. A number of the people wanted to break off and be their own town. Half of them did, half of them didn't. Ties with Salem had its advantages, but you didn't have to pay taxes to people to help with projects far away from your neighborhood and things like that. They didn't have to help stand guard duty down by the harbor and leave their own families unprotected against these raids that might have come, although they didn't. They had reasons to want to separate. And within the town, there was controversy as to whether they'd hired the right minister or not. It was in his household that the girl started to act afflicted. And half of the congregation wanted to keep him, and half of the congregation wanted him out. And there must have been all sorts of personality conflicts that you'll never know about, but a few of them show up in the trial papers. For example, Rebecca Nurse, one of the six, the neighbor's pigs had gotten into her garden, and pigs can really make a mess of things. They root around and they have sharp hooves. So she had a big argument with the neighbor's husband, and he took sick and died sometime after that, and the widow never really trusted Rebecca after that.
So, in other words, because her husband got sick and died, then...
After the big argument,
it had to be Rebecca who was responsible.
Well, you never know, that sort of thing, yeah.
I see. Well, of course, if you never know, then how can you execute people? Right. Well, so, in other words, the accusations of witchcraft were kind of a scapegoat for the many bad things that were going on.
Yes, consciously or unconsciously, yes.
And did people ever lie to get rid of adversaries or to profit from their property or something by calling them a witch and hoping they would be executed?
Well, yeah, what are people's motives? Maybe they were too willing to believe the worst of a neighbor. It's hard to say what was going on in the backs of their minds. They may well have lied about some things, but you didn't get the neighbor's property. That was not going to help you. In 92, because of the difference with the law, having to conform to English law, there were confiscations of movable property by the county, I guess you could say, which was supposed to keep things from being hidden away before the fines and the king's theoretically the king's share was taken. But most of the stuff seems to have been used. Well, some of it maybe went into the wrong pockets, but a lot of it got used to feed the prisoners, too. Things got sold. Cattle got sold rather cheaply. And according to Philip English, Mary English is one of the six. Philip is the richest man in Salem, and he writes this angry letter afterwards wanting his considerable property back, and he says this was squandered to feed the prisoners. Maybe squandered didn't sound as harsh then, but some of it apparently did go to help them. But land, for example, was not taken, and some of the families who were, like George Jacobs, who's not in the book, but he hangs, and the family keeps the land until the Great Depression in the 1920s when the bank foreclosed on it. And as far as Rebecca Nurse went, she didn't own anything because she's a married woman. Her husband owns it.
I see.
That stayed in the family for many generations.
And the husband was never found...
No, he wasn't accused.
Yeah. And was it only women, or were men accused also?
No, men were accused. Not as many. It was easier for a woman to seem like she was out of line. But there were five or six men who were executed in 1692 that same summer for witchcraft, including a minister.
Really?
Yeah.
What are some of the behaviors that would manifest that would convince people that they were guilty of witchcraft?
Well, let's see. If someone was always quarrelsome and hard to get along with, I mean, wouldn't that just please the devil?
I know a few witches, I think.
I better watch my step at times, too. Someone's cranky. The usual suspect before 92, when just about anybody, it seems, could be suspected. Usually it was older women who maybe a widow or someone with not a lot of family to speak up for her, somebody without a lot of resources, so that they may be asking favors once too often for the neighbor's patience. But if they were cranky on top of that, that certainly didn't help. Let's see, but what was it? Somebody who led a lewd and profligate life, it's a phrase that one of the textbooks of the time mentioned, that you couldn't be sure if they weren't in the devil's pocket either, because that's the sort of thing the devil encourages. But, yeah.
Do you mean prostitution or what?
Oh, well, lewd seems to cover all that. But just, you know, someone who isn't as modest as they might be, perhaps.
I see.
But
so it doesn't have to go so far as prostitution. It can
I wouldn't
be...
think so, but that was an English book that they were quoting from.
I see. Huh. So you could just go outside with, you know, with short sleeves and maybe you'd be a kid.
Well, not quite that.
That's fascinating. We're talking to Marilyn K. Roach, and her book is called Six Women of Salem, The Untold Story of the Accused and Their Accusers in the Salem Witch Trials. I guess the most famous fictional account of the witch trials is Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible.
Yes.
Can you comment on the accuracy of that?
Well, yeah. He did rearrange history for the sake of the drama. I mean, the point of it is not being believed when you're telling the truth, and that certainly was the case. But the whole accusation for Proctor, John Proctor, seems to hinge on his supposed affair with Abigail Williams. And in real life, he's in his 60s and she's 11. And they lived across town from each other, so that didn't happen. And actually, he lived over the border from Salem Village in Salem, but not part of the congregation that had to pay, whose taxes went to pay the minister that has the controversy in Salem Village. So that wouldn't affect Proctor. He rearranged history sort of like Shakespeare does it, you know, so all good playwrights can do it. But the point of his play is not being believed when you are telling the truth.
So the spirit of it is accurate.
Well, it keeps happening in history, human nature.
Right, right. Well, in about 1711, then, they kind of realized that they'd been wrong?
Yeah, well, actually before that, although some people never did admit it. They did pull back from what they were doing in October of 1692. They canceled the November trials. September was a particularly awful month for people getting arrested, and eight were hanged that month, which were the last ones, but of course they didn't know that at the time.
They thought that, between getting arrested and being hanged, how long a period would...
Oh, well, it could be a couple of months, but one man was within a month, I think. Less than that. But some people stayed in jail almost a year and survived because it just sort of ended without them coming to trial before things had calmed down.
Well, so people came to their senses at a
certain point. They pulled back, and the government decided, because there was more and more opposition going on, they decided that if they did not admit spectral evidence, that is, visions of spirits and stuff, which could be an illusion or the devil's illusions being sent to confuse things, if they didn't accept that as evidence, then they would try some people. And because the jails are full, they have to put them somewhere. So there were more trials in January of 93 now. And three people were found guilty, but they did not die eventually. They just got reprieved of it sometime afterwards. And then the rest of the trials for other counties, which went through to May, no one was found guilty because they weren't accepting spectral evidence. They had to admit that that was only making things worse. And in 1697... there was a public fast, which means people were encouraged to go to their church services in their own congregations, and it would be like an apology to God and the community for various things that were going wrong that just upset the whole of civic life and life generally. There were a number of things that were involved in that fast order, but the main thing was that the witch trials had just gone wrong, and that time, Samuel Sewell, one of the judges, stood up, in addition to just attending the service, he stood up in his congregation in Boston and had the minister read a more personal apology for getting things so wrong.
So it was as if a spell had been cast on these people.
Well, human nature doesn't need too much to make it do the wrong thing sometimes.
At what point did the people involved... So this guy, he stood up and expressed regret, and did people just immediately? Was there a point where they just were humiliated or horrified by what had happened? Or
depended. Certainly, the families of the accused never let it drop. Some of them, that is, like Rebecca Nurse's family, they continued to, hound the minister who had been convinced that for a time he did say he was wrong. For a time that witches were afflicting his children and the family. But he admitted he was wrong, but it was too little too late as far as the bereaved were concerned. Some people never really thought that that they had been wrong, or that they weren't necessarily part of the trials or the accusations, but they thought something shady had been going on. But most people, I think, just didn't want to talk about it because it was too embarrassing. And that attitude apparently continued for a couple of generations in the area, according to what I've heard. But, the survivors petitioned to clear their names for the reasons I said, because, you didn't know if the government was going to make good on the guilty verdict. So they got their names cleared in 1711. And then the following year, 1712, the government did make some monetary restitution to the survivors or the heirs for expenses like room and board expense in jail. You had to pay for that then. Yeah. And some of the things they had lost, and time taken away from farming to go all the way down to Boston to visit people in jail, because people were in jail in three counties. There were so many there, so... It didn't really make total amends, but it was something.
Well, was Rebecca Nurse the oldest of your...
She may have been. There was an older woman, Mary Bradbury, who actually her family engineered an escape for her. She was found guilty, and then suddenly she wasn't in jail anymore.
Oh, yeah.
But poor Rebecca did not escape. Of the six, she is the oldest.
How old was she when she died?
In her 70s. I do have her birth year. I'm not good at math.
That's all right. And how about the youngest? Who was the youngest then?
The youngest who was hanged, you mean?
Yes.
Well, they're all, let me see, they're all grown people. So.
Yeah, there were no young girls.
Oh, no, there was some girls arrested, but they did not hang. They didn't. They were the daughters of some of the suspects in Andover, the next town, which actually had more suspects than Salem did. But they were paroled, actually, in the fall. And then if their cases were dismissed. But the youngest was Sarah Good's daughter, Dorothy, who was five or six. Four or five, actually. And she stayed in jail in Boston. And her mother was hanged, so she was there alone some months. So she was never quite right afterwards, and that's the saddest one.
Well, you know, the book is so detailed. Were there really good records kept? How were you able to put pieces together?
Well, you know, it's never enough when you want to know it all.
Yeah.
But, yes, there are a lot of records that did survive. And one reason I think the whole business about these trials I remembered more is because the records were better and it was never actually forgotten. And there, besides the, like arrest warrants and jail bills, they can be interesting. But there's also the questioning from the hearings, not the trials themselves, but the hearings when they're first arrested and questioned. There's questions and answers, and some of them are more detailed than others. There's testimonies from neighbors and other people as to what they thought was going on, and sometimes people speaking up for the accused. There were dozens of neighbors signed a petition for Rebecca Nurse. They actually put their names down, identifying themselves as supporting her, which could have been dangerous, but it didn't do her any good.
Right,
but,
because only witches would stand up for another witch, right?
Yeah, that people might think that, but they did. They were not accused, fortunately. And there was commentary published quite close to the trials, arguing whether the courts had been right or wrong, and anecdotes that were preserved by the angry families afterwards, so that there's little details of life that you get, like when John Proctor's kitchen goods were taken away as confiscated by the government. They dumped the broth out of the cooking pot, and it puts out the fire. Whoever was doing it was not being sympathetic. His hired girl, the maid in the family, Mary Warren, is the youngest, I think, of the six in the title. She accuses just about, she's accused in the beginning, she thinks she's afflicted, then she realizes she's not because the proctors slap some sense into her. And then she's accused, and she's so scared out of her mind, she confesses, and then she accuses everybody they suggest to her. So she made a mess of things, but her story is tied in with the proctors.
Well, it's really a fascinating story, and Marilyn K. Roach has done all this research so that you don't have to, and now you can read this amazing story. Six Women of Salem, the untold story of the accused and their accusers in the Salem witch trials. Marilyn K. Roach, thank you so much for sharing some of your stories with us here on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank Marilyn K. Roach. Her book is called Six Women of Salem, The Untold Story of the Accused and Their Accusers in the Salem Witch Trials. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.